Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, live in New York, and this is Reliable Sources, where we examine the story behind the story and we figure out what's reliable. This hour, Alex Jones on trial, compelled to pay for his lies after facing these Sandy Hook family members. But will the jury's decision do anything to actually curtail conspiracy culture? Plus, in a week full of surprises, an abortion rights vote in Kansas that stunned the pundit class. What did they miss? And what should the press learn for next time? And later, two new hires at The View and what it means about the media's treatment of the GOP. Today, we have seven guests that you rarely, if ever, see on TV. Fresh perspectives. So let's get right to it. First up, an exclusive interview with a Biden aide who just left the White House. When it comes to President Biden, there's been a very sudden shift in the narrative winds. I'm sure you felt it. Headlines are describing this week as one of the biggest and one of the best of the Biden presidency, filled with, quote, political wins and policy victories, and many of those so-called wins happening while he was in isolation after testing positive for COVID. I suppose another win this weekend is that he's now COVID-free. So is the press pulling all of it together? Is the news getting through? Some prominent Democrats don't think so. They are calling out the media in these tweets. Here's Democratic strategist Liz Smith tweeting that the media 2 weeks ago was saying Biden's weak, ineffective, responsible for high gas prices, inflation. She says the media now is saying that Biden deserves no credit for anything good, whether or not he's directly responsible for it. But the shift in the winds doesn't blow away inflation. It doesn't blow away monkeypox or homelessness or illegal border crossings. There are still many reasons for the media to be skeptical. But it's notable to see this narrative change. One person who can help us assess it is Michael LaRosa. He worked for Biden's presidential campaign in 2020 as Jill Biden's traveling press secretary and chief spokesman. Then he joined the administration as press secretary to the First Lady and special assistant to the president. He just recently signed off from the White House. There's his sign off on Twitter. And he joins us here now for his first TV interview. So, Michael, in a prior life, you were an MSNBC producer. So now here you are on the other side of the camera.
Yes.
You know the narrative out there and what this week was like.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the average American, the average member of the viewing public, actually heard all of this, what was good news for the White House?
I hope so. If the local headlines are anything like the national headlines, which I assume most of them are, actually, top of the fold newspaper that I saw had the surprising jobs report. I mean, it's not just that. It's just, you know, 500,000 new jobs added in July alone. Record unemployment rate. Record employment rate. Lowest unemployment rate. Apologies. But it was funny because you had a guest on last week, Liz Mayer, who was critiquing the president, and she's a Republican, so I totally make sense. Who was saying that he wasn't handling the economy right, and it was all because of substance. I'm just not sure the analysis held up all week.
Well, doesn't it feel that every week there's a total change in the narrative? I mean, that's the sense I sometimes get from the political class.
Yeah.
Every week it's either really high up, really high down, really low down,
yeah.
And maybe it's never that simple.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's going to be the challenge. Is this was a great week, best week of his presidency. The question will be, can they sustain this through the fall? But more importantly, can it energize people to go out and vote for Democrats?
So tell me about the reason you decided to leave the White House when you did. There's been a bunch of departures lately, so
yeah.
let's get that out of the way. Why did you decide to leave as the FLOTUS press secretary?
Oh, I've now been with the First Lady since 2019, almost 3 years. I joined on the campaign as her traveling press secretary, and we traveled many miles together in minivans through Iowa and through the highs and lows of that campaign, and there were many. And, at the White House, that schedule kind of kept up, and we did 78 cities in the first 18 months, close to 40 states and 10 countries.
So you're ready for a break?
Ready for a break, yeah.
Okay. So tell us what the Bidens really think about this, about the media coverage. You have unique insight.
They love it.
Being the press secretary for the First Lady of the United States, what do the president and the First Lady really think about the media coverage?
Well, and I love history. I love studying presidents. I've been studying them since I was 6 years old. I don't know of any president who has never been frustrated with his press coverage.
Right, so Biden is.
And
what is he frustrated about?
I think it's fair to say both of them could be frustrated at times, but like they're not trying to work the refs or anything. But I would say I think reporters are just as frustrated with the White House. Look, we can be boring White House, right?
Boring. You think the press finds the White House boring?
I think the president and First Lady would love for the press to be talking about substance through the next 3 months straight instead of polls and popularity and all the other things that they've been writing about.
But boring compared to what? I guess you mean boring compared to the prior president, Donald Trump.
Yeah, of course. You know, this is a president who puts his head down, does his work. He's not a showman. He's not out there performing. He actually is doing the business of governing the country. And I think the former president enjoyed the performance aspect of the job, but he didn't seem to have much interest in being a steward of the people or running a government. And that was part of the reason why I think Democrats chose Joe Biden the last time. They were
in the opposite direction. But is that partly why we're not seeing President Biden give many TV interviews? We can put the data on screen comparing him to past presidents. You know, it's been a constant frustration of the press corps that President Biden is rarely sitting down for TV interviews. I know the First Lady has given several this year, but does he avoid TV cameras for that reason?
God, no. I think he loves engaging with the press. Every time I see him, he's talking to the press before he gets onto Marine One. He's taking questions at events more than most presidents do. I think you'll probably see more of him, but I also don't think, I think that misses the forest from the trees when it comes to the midterms, right? The question will be not, he should do more interviews, sure, but it's going to be, can the wins that he racked up this week and for the last 18 months, and many anchors, CNN, MSNBC have noted, they've never really seen this many accomplishments in such a short period of time, in 18 months. Can they harness that and, energize voters.
All right, you left out Fox there. I've always wanted to know how the president and the first lady actually feel about Fox. Do they watch the anti-Biden coverage? Does it get to them?
Oh, God, I don't think the first lady would ever know where to find Fox.
She can't find it on the channel.
She doesn't watch Fox. No, she doesn't know about those things unless I tell her. She's doing other things.
Well, sometimes you would have to tell her. So what was that like?
Absolutely. You know, look, I think whenever your husband is attacked, or whenever your family is attacked, it stings. And I don't think even in the decades that she's been a political spouse, I don't think that ever goes away. But I don't think we should ignore Fox either. I don't think Democrats should ignore Fox. I think it's an opportunity, not always a threat. I think when they go too far, you call them out as you would anybody. And occasionally, I have done that.
So you were encouraged, that was your advice inside the White House, is the Biden administration should engage with Fox.
I mean, I don't give the West Wing advice, but we always thought that the First Lady did, I think, two Fox interviews, Dana Perino and Shannon Bream, during the primary and the general election. And we posted an editorial on FoxNews.com. We thought that they were good opportunities.
What about when there's an eruption of negative attention? Most recently, when the First Lady was talking about Hispanics and she made a reference to tacos in San Antonio, there was this immediate reaction, both from journalists as well as from right-wing commentators saying that she had offended the Hispanic community.
Yeah.
You had to put out a tweet apologizing on her behalf. What are those calculations like about when to step back and apologize?
Well, look, I think she would never intentionally offend anyone, and that wasn't why. Actually, if you were in the room, people clapped and cheered. She was making
it is a, true that some reporters in the room said it didn't seem offensive in the room. At
well,
the time.
Because she was making a point. She was referencing a local point of pride.
But then
in
it becomes
San Antonio.
A 3-day long story in right wing media, and you must have felt the need to tamp down the fire by apologizing.
Yeah, when you offend somebody, even if it's not intentional, of course, and that's the kind of person she is. She has a big heart. She never wants to offend anybody, but she's not going to stop reaching out to the Latino community. She's been doing it a very long time. This is somebody who flies all across the country just to honor Cesar Chavez, and that's just one example, but she's been conducting a lot of Latino outreach, and that's not going to stop.
Did you ever have times where you wanted to fire off a response and others pulled you back? I mean, this is a White House that doesn't seem to engage that aggressively the way we did see with the Trump White House.
Yeah, and I think there were many times my colleagues wanted to take away my keyboard.
Oh, really?
I think, when they go too far, I think they need to be called out, whether it's Fox or anybody else. And,
Do you see, take it away right with media for a moment, do you see times that other news outlets are treating the First Lady and the President unfairly?
Absolutely.
Tell me about it.
You know, the First Lady was honoring the service of Nancy Reagan and the introduction of her stamp a couple months ago. And, she got some pushback because of it happened to be June 1st.
Well, Reagan's history
on AIDS. People were talking, and that wasn't the goal, right? That wasn't the context. The context was a First Lady honoring another First Lady. It wasn't it wasn't Nancy Reagan's policy. Just like they're not Jill Biden's policies, right? She was honoring a predecessor of hers. And, she took some heat. And, it surprised a lot of us. It was not something that we expected, but... she can take the hits.
When you're in the job, do you end up being on defense a lot more than you expect?
No.
She kind of implied that in an interview recently, one of the fundraisers, talking about, we had all these plans, but we've come in, we've had to respond to so many crises.
Well, look, there are challenges, and I don't think she'd be the first one to say that. But I think it goes back to this frustration and whether the press is going to continue to cover the substance or, substance isn't sexy, right? It doesn't sell. It's not confrontational. It's not controversial. Keep analyzing the president in a way that focuses on the substance and his accomplishments, of which there have been many over the last 18 months. And it's been really unprecedented to see.
So you want coverage of steak, not sizzle. Let me ask one sizzle question.
Yeah.
Maureen Dowd's column in this morning's New York Times basically says that Joe Biden should not run for re-election. This has been a narrative for months, and it's getting louder and louder, including from some Democratic lawmakers saying Biden should basically hang it up and say he's a lame duck and not run 2024. So where do you come down on this as a former White House aide?
Oh, I hope he runs, and I know he's going to run. I think he's planning to run, as he said many times. But look, I think that this is arriving right on time. It's Democratic bedwetting time. In 1995, right around this time, R.W. Apple wrote a piece in the New York Times.
Wait, are you saying the media is predictable?
Very predictable.
This
is very
but
cyclical.
It's different this time.
Bill
given
Clinton,
Biden's
Barack
age.
Obama, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama.
Well,
they
Biden's
all said.
Biden's age makes it different.
Well, to you guys, but after you look at the week he just had and those wins that he racked up while he had COVID, I don't see why he wouldn't run. I haven't heard the reason why.
What about Hunter? Hunter under federal investigation. Charges could be coming at any time. This is not just a right-wing media story. This is a real problem for the Bidens. Mm-hmm. Could he decide not to run for re-election given his son?
Look, they make decisions as a family, and they will make that decision when it's time. But
Think they've talked about it yet?
No. The president's doing his job. He's doing his work. He's not focused on that. It's 19 months. Why would he be doing that?
Okay, so you're saying the press is getting ahead of...
Way ahead, way ahead. Look, there's more work to do. It's been 19 months, and, he intends to run, like you said. But I think the focus should be from the press on how what he is doing is affecting people out in the country. Because these are things that Democrats have wanted to get done for a long time. And just a week, veterans, manufacturing... the unemployment rate. It's been remarkable to see a president rack up so many substantive wins, as even your anchors have noted in the last year.
Michael, thank you very much for coming on.
Yes, of course.
Great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Coming up, these news outlets are usually bitter rivals. But right now, they're working together to try to force some transparency about the Uvalde massacre, and we're going to tell you how. But first, Alex Jones on trial, the first of many trials. We're going to talk with two podcasters who were in the courtroom this week.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Alex Jones lost in court this week, but the conspiracy culture he symbolizes is winning. Right now, the effort to hold Jones accountable for his lies about the Sandy Hook massacre is really just getting started, though. He has other trials that he faces for damages. This is going to go on for months, probably go on for years. But the jury's decision on Friday that Jones should face punitive damages to the tune of $45 million, it was a bold statement. It was a reckoning that was 10 years in the making. And my next guests were in the courtroom for part of the trial to witness it firsthand. They've spent five of their years of their lives dedicated to covering Jones, skewering Jones and his InfoWars website on a podcast called Knowledge Fight. Dan Friesen and Jordan Holmes launched the podcast in 2017. And on it, they use comedy to cut through crazy lies. They've produced more than 700 episodes. They turned it into a full-time career. And they flew to Texas to see the trial in person. Dan and Jordan are back home in Chicago now, and they're joining me live. Welcome to you both. Dan, what was the most impactful moment for you in that courtroom in Texas?
Definitely, I think anybody who was there in person would have a really impossible time answering anything other than the moment when Scarlett Lewis, who lost her son in the Sandy Hook massacre, was able to give her testimony in court. While Alex was sitting in court, her being able to face him and tell her story and speak her from her heart was, I think, something that will I think will stay with pretty much everyone there for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. Jordan, you all specialize in mocking Alex Jones, but was there anything funny or mockable out of this?
I think people would like to focus on Alex being kind of a bombastic character that we can mock and make fun of, but this isn't about him. I think everybody wants to make it about him and money and politics, and what it's about is Scarlett Lewis and Neil Heslin and Jesse Lewis.
It was pretty funny how much unnecessary security he had, though.
There was an Ocean's 11 size number of security detail around him, yes.
Interesting. I didn't see that. I didn't know that. So that's why it's important to be there in person. Look, you all have been doing this for 5 years. I bet it's changed a lot for you. You know, having to think about Alex Jones every day, how has it changed as these legal cases have mounted? And frankly, it's come home to roost for him.
How has it changed looking at him? Watching him?
Yeah, I mean, you're studying a person who seemed untouchable for a long time, but now is in serious legal jeopardy and financial jeopardy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's definitely an interesting experience because you have a bit more attention being put on this subject that otherwise, you know, tends to just end up trending on Twitter every now and again, or mm-hmm. you know, not a ton of directed attention at him. Whereas with this trial, a lot has come on it. But personally, I enjoy something a little bit more substantial. And during this whole stretch of time, his content itself has been essentially hollow. And so, you know, watching him from my perspective has gotten a lot less interesting.
Is it fair to say that what InfoWars represents, this conspiracy view of the world full of nonsense, that it's spread everywhere, that it's spread outward, so there's not one InfoWars anymore, there's 100 versions of it across the web. Is that fair?
I think I would argue that the conspiracy culture is something that is, you know, created through the cracks of our regular society. You know, it's not built from conspiracy outwards to racism and violence and all of that stuff. It's the desire for racism and the like that leads to conspiracy, that kind of situation.
That's a really interesting way
to
put it.
So yes, it's gotten a lot bigger.
it's gotten bigger. And Dan, with that in mind, how do you all approach Knowledge Fight? How have you, and this is now, tell me if I'm wrong, this is a full-time job now. You all have made a career out of scrutinizing and skewering Alex Jones.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we approach it with the understanding that it's a serious topic, but also that in order to make it interesting for anybody to listen to, you have to make something entertaining. And so, I mean, one of the advantages of being in a podcast format is you can really take your time, whereas a lot of other media formats, you can't. And so, the approach to taking Alex as he is involves something that other media formats probably don't have the time to do, which is explain the mechanisms of like what he's doing and why these conspiracy narratives exist, what purpose they serve, and the mechanics of them.
Well, tell us the number one trick. Tell us the number one trick that he employs.
Ah, making things up.
Well,
that's the simple one for sure.
It's a good start. Yeah.
And give us one more, then, Jordan.
I would say his number one trick is the ad pivot. He goes from screaming about how the world is going to end to then selling you food that'll help you survive the end of the world. So that's a pretty neat trick, I would suppose. Yeah. Mm.
Do y'all ever get bored of listening to him?
Yes.
He does all the listening and I do all the talking, so.
Yeah, I would say that it's an incredibly boring experience, which is part of the reason that I do this is because I can stomach that boredom, whereas other people probably, it would be a miserable experience for them to do that so they could be in a place where they could better understand what Alex is doing and what he brings to the table. But
yeah, I only consume it through clips. The big question, I suppose, for both of you are these trials going to tamp down conspiracy culture? Do you all believe what the defense attorneys say, what the prosecutors say, the attorneys for the families, which is he needs to be held accountable so that others don't go out and lie in the future? Is that going to work or is it futile?
I think that it can have some effect, but I think that, you hopefully will end up in a situation where people are not as capricious in the future, but the effect may ultimately end up being that conspiracy producers and people who engage in the sorts of conduct that Alex does end up becoming a little bit savvier and end up learning where the lines are better of what they can do and what they can get away with. So I don't know if it's a severe blow, but hopefully it'll limit a lot of the harm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
When he's taken down, hopefully, it will create something of a vacuum. So I'm sure some people will kind of fill that vacuum, but they won't be as powerful, they won't be as big, and they won't have the same size of audience. Hmm. So yeah, I think it's going to help.
Jordan and Dan, thank you both for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to look at the headlines out of the CPAC conference in Texas, talk about how to cover GOP extremism. And later, what do all of these stories have in common? The co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network will tell us. There are tax cut Republicans, and then there are treason Republicans. There are those who think January 6th was god-awful and those who think it was glorious. The challenge in covering the present-day GOP is to see and show and tell the difference. I mean, many Republicans know that the Stop the Steal stuff is bunk, but it's still alive and unwell nearly 2 years later. Some actively speak out against it for that reason, but, they're losing. The Republicans that want their party to be reasonable and reality-based are losing. At least if you look at CPAC and the recent conservative conference and the likes of Mike Lindell on stage repeating election lies. I mean, think about it. There are many election deniers, many people who pretend or actually believe that the 2020 election was corrupt, despite all the evidence. And some of these deniers are winning GOP primaries, meaning they could be running elections in the future, or at least influencing how those elections are run. It's kind of like picking a guy who can't count to teach you math. Suddenly, you're learning to subtract instead of add. But it's happening. So how is this phenomenon being covered? How should it be covered? Some headlines call candidates election deniers. There are other headlines, let me show you one from the Associated Press, calling them merely skeptics. I think that's a really interesting difference. And of course, these words matter. The language matters a lot. So let me bring in a panel of guests to talk about this and a whole lot more. Here in New York with me, Lauren Wright, a political scientist at Princeton University, author of Star Power, American Democracy in the Age of the Celebrity Candidate. Also with me, Elaine Godfrey, staff writer of The Atlantic, who just penned a new piece on this subject. And Howard Polskin, president and chief curator of The Writing, which tracks headlines from across the right-wing media hemisphere. Welcome to everybody. Elaine, let me start with you, because you had this writing challenge recently, choosing which words to use. There's a big difference between saying election skeptics and, I don't know, democracy destroyers. How did you think about the writing, the choice of language for your recent article?
It's really tough because I think you don't want to be too dismissive of these folks. You don't want people to sort of assume that, they're so crazy you shouldn't even pay attention to them. But you don't. You also don't want to, I think calling them election skeptics is a little bit too polite. Most of these people are beyond skepticism. And we talk about this all the time at The Atlantic when I'm writing, because I sort of have this mini beat of election denial. And we say, stop the steal candidates. We say election denial. I at a magazine, I sort of have a little more free rein to call them what I want. I sometimes call them liars, because I think that they are. And I think it is really important for journalists to be very, very clear about what's going on here. They're not just sort of questioning. They are lying or being actively sort of deluded by Trump.
Being clear about the threat to democracy is one of the most important things that American journalists can do. However, Lauren, doesn't that turn off a sizable part of the country? Doesn't it turn off a sizable part of the country every time we're talking about election deniers?
Well, it's the responsibility of journalists to report the facts, and I completely understand why covering Trump's potential candidacy in 2024 is an extremely important story. I mean, this is a person that's actively subverting American democracy. But then when there's media reporting on how Trump dominated the CPAC poll, he got 69% compared to Ron DeSantis with 24%. That is utterly uninformative of where things will be
in 2 years.
Yes.
Right, because you know, as a political scientist, that's just unscientific. It's just whoever happened to be at the conference, the most hard-right activists.
Yes, that's exactly right. And we know that there's just not enough information right now to predict anything this far out. There's too much noise. Nobody's paying attention. And so we do need to take these sorts of things with a grain of salt or ignore them altogether, frankly.
We're going to get more into predictions in just a moment. Howard, what do you see when you're scanning the right-wing media world, seeing these headlines? The Daily Caller, those sites, they say Democrats are the ones trying to steal elections, trying to destroy democracy. So we should be clear, there's a house of mirrors things going on, a phenomenon going on here.
There's no question about it. What I'm seeing, first of all, is that in the last 2 months, the right-wing press has not really focused on Stop the Steal. And I'm looking at 20 to 40 conservative websites every morning. They're focusing on J6. They're focusing on monkeypox. They are
moving on from Trump's election lies.
Well, not quite, because I think that all changed after this past week with Kerry Lake.
Okay, winning in Arizona, the GOP primary.
Yes, I'm already seeing stories that are suggesting that focusing on Kerry Lake and Stop the Steal, and I think we're going to see many more of these stories happening in the next few months.
Elaine, you just wrote about Kerry Lake. What was the most important takeaway from Arizona this week for the press?
The most important takeaway from Arizona is that they just sent a whole slate of election deniers, whatever you'd like to call them. people who believe that 2020 was stolen, or say they believe 2020 was stolen. Carrie Lake has said that as governor, she would decertify the results. I'm not sure there's any basis for that at all. There's no procedure for what happens after you do that. And I think something important to know about Carrie Lake is she is a huge MAGA personality now. Like, she is a hero in Trump world. And you know, win or lose, she's sort of going to go on and be this MAGA superstar. So I think people should become familiar with this person.
Democrats talk about Carrie Lake. They say she's an extremist. They say extremists are winning primaries. But, Lauren, I've seen a lot of words get redefined in recent years. Fake news, disinformation. I think the word extremist is the next one. Biden's going to call Republicans extremists. Republicans are going to say, great, we are extremely pro-family. Or whatever they're going to say, they're going to redefine the term. And I just wonder at this point, is there any language, is there any common language that you teach in your courses?
Well, in general, in political science, when we talk about extremism, it's these polar opposites of the ideological scale. So the most conservatives, you could say, are extremist, but it's really hard not to conflate that with election lies and conspiracies, and it's really important we cover these people. What's so hard for the GOP right now is that extremists win because at the primary stage, the voters are much more conservative in this case than general election voters, but moderates would almost always do better in a general election, and that's one of the most tried and true research findings that
right.
we have.
There's the tension.
Yep.
Hey, so you were on The View earlier this year. You tried out for the conservative seat. They call it a conservative seat, which I find a little bit strange. So the ABC announced this week two new co-hosts, Alyssa Farah Griffin and Ana Navarro, both CNN commentators, are both now co-hosts of The View. I wondered, partly because you were on the show, partly because, I don't know, it's kind of an awkward question, but if the Republican Party is still dominated by MAGA, by the Trump phenomenon, and you have Alyssa and Ana, who are both wonderful, but they're anti-Trump Republicans, is The View not actually representing the Republican mainstream?
Well, they just have such a remarkable team over there, I'll say. And I had such a positive experience, even if my views personally are different from some of the hosts. But actually, it's a pretty tricky question, because if you look at polling, about half of Republicans don't want Trump to run again. According to some great CNN polling, the majority of Republicans think he acted unethically on January 6th and that he didn't do enough to stop the violence. And so we actually do have a lot of evidence that even mainstream Republicans are questioning Trump's role in the party, and they're not sure if he should even be the future of the party. So you could argue that the extremists are the smaller portion of the party, and that a lot of Republicans really want to see if this is the best direction forward, and a lot of them want to win. So it might, in fact, be representative.
That's interesting. I guess I'm imagining like a Steve Bannon type sitting at the table. And
well,
that was
there
never
should not
happen.
Be a Steve Bannon seat.
Why?
I don't know.
Why?
Should there be a Marjorie Taylor Greene seat where people are just on a different planet? I don't know.
Well, here's my
you
concern.
Could argue otherwise.
Here's my concern.
Yeah.
If we don't have those voices on you know, mainstream network TV, aren't we missing what's happening in the grassroots?
Well, it's dangerous to spread election misinformation and lies. And so you can have guests, and I think you can have healthy debates, and I will debate anyone on television. That's fine with me. I'll talk to anyone, and I'm sure you feel the same way as a journalist, but the facts need to be put into context.
These
and
are the tensions
in some
exist,
formats,
yeah.
that's very difficult to do, and it's really important to do so.
All right, lots more with the guests in just a moment. We're going to talk about that shock result in Kansas that no one saw coming, but maybe we all should have seen coming. We're going to get into that in just a couple moments.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
In a week full of surprises, one story seemed to catch the political press off guard. It was out of Kansas. Here's the front page of Wednesday's Kansas City Star showing the emotion as shocking results poured in. The headline, Kansas votes to protect abortion rights in state constitution. No one was predicting, seemed almost nobody was predicting such a one-sided outcome, such a landslide victory. Headlines called it unexpected and a stunner. Of course, less shocking was the coverage out of Indiana, another abortion vote, this time by the state legislature. The result was all too predictable. It was expected for weeks, actually. The Republican-controlled state legislature passing a near-total ban on abortion, just as they had promised they would do. Here's the Indy Star headline about the governor signing that ban into law on Friday. So a tale of two states. But what does it say about the press being so surprised by Kansas? Back with me, Elaine Godfrey, Howard Polskin, and Lauren Wright. Should the media, Lauren, have been surprised by the Kansas outcome?
No. Support for abortion rights in Kansas is about 55%. There are only 10 states in the U.S. where that supports less than 50%. And so this actually was in line with the majority of Americans who support abortion in some form or another. And when you ask people about a policy in a poll, you might get a different result than if you ask them about a party or a candidate.
So you mean if you're polling about a candidate, people go to their corners, but if
yes,
you poll on a policy,
and
or
there's
you
a
have
variety.
A, I see,
direction.
Right.
Yep.
Howard, was this story a big deal? Was the Kansas vote a big deal in right-wing media?
No, it was almost ignored. You know, they were focusing more on Brittany Griner.
Important story.
The latest issues around Hunter Biden, problems in electric vehicles. Because those are cars for the liberal elite. So things like the abortion vote, ignored.
Right. It's interesting because it was obviously, you know, it's been years, it's been decades in the making to have Roe v. Wade overturned. But once it's happened, now these state-level decisions are being made, not as much attention.
Exactly.
Elaine, to me, it seems so important to have state-level coverage of these issues, all of these states making these important choices. And most importantly of all, we need to hear about what it's like for women. There's a New York Times headline, big headline out today, about some women self-managing their care, taking medication, having abortions at home without doctor supervision or help or assistance. You know, these are the stories now that we need to tell in the press about real people and not just the politicians.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is the stuff that matters, right? These are the real people who are dealing with the real consequences of this stuff. And I think Kansas was not surprising if you look at that data. But I think, you know, midterms, we're not expecting Democrats to turn out. We're not expecting, and not everyone who voted a no on the proposition was a Democrat, obviously. But I think there's a reason that was held in a midterms year. There's a reason it was held sort of in a time when, like, they were expecting sort of a sleepy turnout, and they got, like, a crazy turnout. And so I think that should be reassuring to Democrats. Maybe not, like, totally. I think that they can be reassured that they can use abortion as an issue going forward, for sure.
Elaine, thank you. Howard and Lauren, thank you all. Coming up, it's what everyone says they want from the media. Not just bad news, not just problems, instead, solutions. Well, the co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network, David Bornstein, is joining me next. The news is too negative. You've probably said it. I sure have. There's a seemingly endless supply of bad news stories out there. I mean, come on. Even this weekend, Kim Kardashian and Pete Davidson breaking up. But in all seriousness, for journalism to affect change, people need answers, not just questions. They need solutions, not just problems. We're not going to repair every celebrity relationship, but the news can help people feel empowered. So you should know this type of journalism exists. It does exist. There's an organization spearheading this movement, fittingly called the Solutions Journalism Network. David Bornstein is CEO and co-founder of the network. He's been a journalist for over 30 years, most recently at the New York Times, where he wrote about efforts to solve social and environmental problems. David, welcome to the program. People need to know what you do. Y'all just announced this week an expansion with four universities to bring this to an even broader population and help train journalists. But take me to the beginning. Why was there a need for Solutions Journalism Network?
Well, journalists had always known that there's a need to report on solutions, but it was always sort of put in the back burner and often on Friday afternoon as sort of seen as a sort of a feel-good kind of story.
Like a feature.
The fact that solutions journalism really needs to be done as rigorous reporting that looks at responses to problems and needs to be seen as hard news was something that wasn't happening. You know, it really does sharpen accountability, it takes away excuses, and it increases trust and engagement. But to make that, you know, these news habits that audiences have and also journalists have always made this a sort of a secondary consideration. Mm. Now you have 42% of Americans who are actively avoiding the news. Because they say it makes them feel powerless and hopeless. And so moving rigorous reporting on solutions to social problems into the core of the news becomes more important, not only just from a business perspective for news organizations that want engagement, but also, you know, we need people to engage with the news at a time when we have a climate crisis and a democracy crisis. We can't have people tuning out now. It's a halt. It's an all hands on deck moment. So that's really why the network was created, to really move that forward.
What's a concrete example of the impact that you've had? Like, is there a story or a set of articles you can point to and say, that's right there, that's solution journalism?
I would say it's more the collection. We have a database called the Solution Story Tracker, and we've tracked more than 13,000 stories in there from 1,700 news organizations. I mean, this is a movement, an approach in journalism that's spreading it. It's being incorporated by the BBC World Service, the New York Times is doing that, The Guardian, but also local news organizations and metro dailies and TV stations across the United States, increasingly in Africa and in Eastern and Western Europe as well. The success really is the network that is now talking to each other and really refashioning the idea of what should news be. Is it information that tells you what's broken all the time, or is it information that helps you understand how to build a better community?
How do you get through to editors and producers and newsroom leaders?
The main thing for editors and newsroom leaders is to really, they care most about accountability. Most journalists feel that our most important thing is to not go soft, especially now, and really hold power to account. But we need to figure out how to ensure accountability without making people feel hopeless and powerless. So when we speak to them and we say, you know, when you actually incorporate solutions journalism into your reporting, what you see is not only better trust and engagement, but you actually see that it sharpens the teeth of the watchdog because it takes away excuses. It's, you know, you can't
really
say we can't do better if you can show here's a school system that's doing better.
Yes, here's the example. So my way of providing solutions today was to bring you on. Where can people find more information about the network?
If you go to the solutionsjournalism.org, which is the website, or go to the Solution Story Tracker, you'll find thousands of stories there and also tools and resources for journalists around the world to be able to figure out how to do this, but really at a high quality level.
Love it. David, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
We've got more reliable sources in a moment. Important news about accountability out of Uvalde, Texas. A quick update on the news media's battle to find out the full truth about what happened in Uvalde, Texas. This week, CNN and a dozen other news outlets joined forces to file a lawsuit against the Texas Department of Public Safety. This media coalition has been fighting for public records about the Robb Elementary massacre for weeks now. Lawyers say Texas officials have been stonewalling, so that's why they're having to go to court to get the facts. These First Amendment lawyers are the best of the best. They and we will get to the truth, no matter how long it takes. Tonight here on CNN, join Anderson Cooper and Shimon Prokupes for a special report, What Really Happened in Uvalde. That's tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on CNN. And we'll see you right back here this time next week.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.